The next case is 001536, State of Ohio versus Singh. Mr. Colada.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Why don't you come up to the microphone, if you would, please, and put that on the record. We tape these, so.
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Your time on the clock there.
Thank you. And may it please the court, good morning. My name is Vince Colada. I was counsel for the state of Ohio at the trial level in this matter, and I'm here this morning on behalf of the state of Ohio, the appellant herein. And I'd like to begin by addressing the first proposition of law that we set forth in our brief, but in doing so, I want to just give a brief procedural history of the appellate history of what happened in this regard, because I don't want to mislead the court in any manner. I don't think we have done that, because we did acknowledge this in our merit brief. But in this particular case, the second assignment of error was what was reversed by the 11th District Court of Appeals. In that second assignment of error, the defendant argued or alleged that the defendant was not fully advised of his right against self-incrimination. And the basis of the defendant's argument at the Court of Appeals level was that he was not fully advised because he wasn't told that his silence can't be used against him to infer guilt. That was the sole basis for his argument at the Court of Appeals for the reason why he wasn't fully advised of his right against self-incrimination. The aspect of compulsion, that the language that the Judge Jackson used at the trial level, that he didn't adequately advise him that he couldn't be compelled to testify, that wasn't argued or alleged by the defendant at the appellate level. It was solely the silence issue. And in that regard, then, the Court of Appeals reversed the second assignment of error. They really don't offer much of an explanation, and I'll get into that in a little bit, but they just basically say what Judge Jackson said, failed to adequately advise him of his rights. We find that the second assignment of error is well-founded. Well, his second assignment of error is totally based on the fact that he was not advised that his silence could be held against him. So in that regard, we filed a motion to certify a conflict with the Court of Appeals, because there are other Court of Appeals around Ohio, which has said that's not necessary. While that motion was pending, our memorandum in support was due in this court, so we had to go forward and file that. Subsequently, the Court of Appeals issued a judgment entry denying our motion to certify, saying that there is no conflict because we didn't hold that he has to be advised that his silence can't be used against him. Our holding was based on the fact that the court's explanation of his rights didn't adequately advise him that he couldn't be compelled to testify. So in that regard, we have the two propositions of law. However, we feel that it is important for this court to address that first proposition of law for several reasons. One, while the court did say in its judgment entry denying certification that that's not what it meant, the language of the opinion says that nowhere. In fact, the language of the opinion by the Court of Appeals is very, very vague. There is no explanation, no basis. They don't explain why Judge Jackson's language, when he tells them, you could testify, but you need not testify if you desire not to, does not fulfill the requirements that you cannot be compelled to testify. All they do, basically, is they go through an analysis of what's required, a legal analysis about how strict compliance with the constitutional rights set forth in Boykin is required. They then say, here's what Judge Jackson said, and they make a blanket statement saying, we find that fails to adequately advise the defendant of his constitutional right against self-incrimination. They then just summarily dismiss the fact that there's a written plea of guilty, which specifically spells out, using the exact language from Criminal Rule 11, they dismiss that saying, it's a written plea of guilty, he's got to personally advise them, and they just go ahead then and say, therefore, his assignment of error is well-founded.
Counsel, how exactly was he harmed?
I'm sorry?
How was the defendant harmed?
I don't believe he was harmed in any manner at all. None whatsoever. The trial court went over an extensive colloquy with the defendant. In fact, even the Court of Appeals, in their opinion, it's sort of ironic. When you read the opinion, it's sort of like two different opinions in one. The first assignment of error, he alleged that he wasn't advised of his nature of his rights. And they go over how the judge went through this extensive colloquy with the defendant, advising him of all his rights, how the attorney acknowledged to the court that we went over the written plea of guilty line by line, advising him of all his rights. He acknowledged to me, he acknowledged to the court he understood all his rights. And in the first assignment of error, the court says we find that he was advised of all his rights. Then when it gets to the second one, when it's specifically about this right against self-incrimination, the court tells him, you could testify, but you need not testify if you desire not to. How that doesn't convey the same meaning as you cannot be compelled to testify against yourself, I don't understand, and I don't believe he was harmed in any manner. He certainly was advised of his right against self-incrimination.
But he did then testify?
This wasn't a trial, Judge. This was a plea.
Okay. But did he make some statement that...
Oh, he acknowledged that he understands that, right?
All right. But did he make some statement subsequent to this advice that in some way jeopardized him in terms of the sentence that the judge imposed?
Oh, not at all.
I didn't think so.
No, none at all. I mean, it was a pretty, quite honestly, a basic plea and a basic sentence. We had the plea. He was referred for a pre-sentence report. We then came back for sentencing. Everybody was afforded the opportunity to speak. And the judge sentenced him. And then also in this particular regard, he is of Indian descent. The judge made available to him an experienced translator who speaks the exact dialect. Punjabi is the dialect that the defendant spoke. And he was made available to the defendant, but the defendant did not need him. He understood English. He understood and communicated well with his attorney. And in fact, the Court of Appeals opinion, again, in the first assignment of error, acknowledges on at least two or three occasions that the defendant understood English very well. There was no problem in communicating with the defendant.
Isn't there a form, a checklist the judge just goes down? I always used to have one. You just check it off and as you go through. Isn't there that form? Does this judge use the form?
The judge has something on his bench that he reads when he goes through it.
The reason I want to know is because I don't ever remember after you advise him they have a right to remain silent, that you say the next thing that the Court of Appeals here says you got to say. I don't think that's on the form.
I don't know if Judge Jackson has a specific, I don't know what he uses. I know he has something on his bench. It's in a notebook.
You've taken a lot of pleas.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Has this ever risen before?
It's never risen before. And to be quite honest with you, what was raised by the defendant at the appeals level wasn't this issue dealing with compulsion. It was the issue...
Cannot be used.
Right, I mean his...
Can't be used against him if he doesn't...
Right, his assignment of error literally at the Court of Appeals was two paragraphs. And in it he said... The assignment of error first said he wasn't fully advised of his right against self-incrimination, but then it goes on to state... that during the hearing, this is what he was told, you cannot testify, but you need not testify if you desire not to. He then says, obviously, this statement falls short of what's required. The court did not explain to the appellant that a decision not to testify cannot be used against him by the jury. This explanation is necessary in order for a criminal defendant to fully understand his constitutional right against self-incrimination. Boykin mandates this explanation, and as a result, the court failed to fully explain.
Why is that not good law?
I'm not saying it's not good law. That is the law. But a
Why should the trial judge have said that here?
Why should he have?
Why should the trial judge have not advised the defendant here that before he took the plea, that if he did not, he said, you know, you can testify if you want to, but you don't have to. Nothing about really about compulsion, I suppose. You can argue about whether, well, if you don't have to, that means nobody can force me to do it.
Exactly.
But then, if I don't testify at the trial, what's the consequence of that? Can that be used against me? Isn't it important for him to know that his silence could not be used against him?
It's not a right that was required under Criminal Rule 11 to advise a defendant of. It's not a right that was set forth by Boykin. It's not a right that was set forth by Ballard, by this court. That right has not been set forth in any court opinions that it's necessary to advise. And as the amicus wrote in their brief, if you start creating different constitutional rights that we need to advise defendants of in order to have a valid plea, then where do you draw the line? Do you start advising them that you have a right to have the prosecutor not exercise peremptory challenges based on race or gender? That's certainly a constitutional trial right, and you certainly should have a right to know that, but we don't advise them of that.
I want to look at procedure for a minute. What happens if we affirm this case?
Defendant comes back. Set for trial.
Is there going to be a motion, you think, to withdraw the plea?
I w- I would imagine. I mean, you have to ask Mr. Partlow that, but I would imagine it would get set back, there would be a motion to vacate the plea, and we would be set for trial.
And then go through the plea agreement and then do it, quote, right.
Or go through a trial. Now, I'm obviously, I'm not in the defendant's shoes, but I'm presupposing that he was unhappy with the judge's sentence in this particular case. He may be expected to get a lesser sentence by entering this plea, and which there was no agreement to. It wasn't there was any agreement that was violated, and he was unhappy once he got sent to prison. This is a case, however, that occurred back in 1984. Where the defendant was charged
with. That's why I'm asking the question. Is there anybody around to testify?
Well, when he finally was brought back, he had fled the country, actually. We found him in Australia. Took 2 years to extradite him back to the state with the help of the U.S. Department of Justice. Once he was brought back, one of our victims was still around. The other one actually had passed away.
Yeah.
It's because they're two separate, unrelated incidents. So we had to dismiss the rape and the kidnapping for one of the incidents, and then we dismissed the attempted rape and kidnapping. We were left with a rape and a kidnapping, and we let him plead a lesser included attempted. I haven't spoke to the victim of the one case that was left since we prepared for trial. This case was actually set for trial the morning of this plea. We went through a suppression hearing. We prepared for trial. We were showed up the morning of the trial. The jury.
How long ago?
I think it was March of 98 that he entered this plea. So that's 3 years now. 3 years ago.
It goes back. She may be gone too.
I haven't spoken to her since the time of the sentencing in this matter. But Judge Moore, to answer your question, yeah, I mean, that is good law, but it's never been required. There's many appellate courts that have ruled that that's not required. And in fact, one of the issues that is a concern is that that is not a requirement to advise the defendant about his silence being used against him. However, defense attorneys continually raise that issue on appeal. And in fact, Mr. Partlow, even in his merit brief, said, I have in the past and I will continue in the future to allege that it is constitutionally required to advise someone that he's of his right against self-incrimination that he be told his silence cannot be used against him. And that is not the law. That's not the law in Ohio. In regards to the second assignment of error, if the court's basis on the first assignment of error wasn't that his silence could be used against him, then to be quite honest with you, the only plausible explanation is that he didn't, word for word, say what was required in Criminal Rule 11. Now, I know the Court of Appeals in their opinions acknowledge that that's not required, but the language, you cannot testify, but you need not testify if you desire not to, conveys the same thing. In fact, I would submit to this court that that language used by Judge Jackson conveys the right against self-incrimination in a manner more easily understandable and more easily intelligible than actually coming out and saying you cannot be compelled to testify against yourself. He used plainer language, simpler language for this defendant to understand. And it goes with the other rights in the same Criminal Rule 11. For example, even with the right of compulsory process. What is compulsory process? I'm having dinner with my wife Friday and ask her that. She's a PhD candidate at Cleveland State. She has no clue what compulsory process is. Now, if a judge were to tell a defendant, you have the right to compulsory process and use that language, that's sufficient. But you're walking on thin ice if you start saying, using your different words, different language to convey that right. And that just doesn't make sense. Ballard says you have to use words which reasonably convey the right in a manner that's reasonably intelligible to the defendant. The judge in this case used simple, plain English, plain language to convey this right to the defendant. And there's no question that it means the same thing.
Do you take a lot of pleas before Jackson, Judge Jackson?
Well, we have, up until this past January, we only had three judges in our common pleas court, so.
Is it possible he used what may be simpler language because of the English difficulties, so he was trying to make it more understandable?
It very well could be that that's what he was trying to do. The other issue I want to bring up, though, is that there was a written plea of guilty in this case. Not only did the judge have the oral colloquy back and forth, but then there's a written plea of guilty, which the judge gives the defendant after he verbally advises him all these rights to review with his attorney and to sign.
The Court of Appeals on page 5 says, referring to that written plea, the document further provided that the appellant if the appellant chose not to plead guilty, then the appellant would be required to prove his guilt, quote, beyond a reasonable doubt at trial in which he could not be compelled to testify against himself, end quote. So the court of appeals found that that language using the words compelled was actually given to the defendant. That seems inconsistent with their final conclusion.
I'm aware of that. They basically dismissed the written plea of guilty entirely because they said the judge has to personally address the defendant of these rights, and therefore this written plea of guilty means nothing. But what's inconsistent about that is when you look at the first assignment of error, they rely on this written plea of guilty when approving that, the fact that the judge made him aware of the nature of his charges. In fact, in the first assignment of error, they talk about how the judge went over this form line by line, how the attorney acknowledged that he went over this form line by line, and that the attorney acknowledged that the defendant told me and the interpreter that he understood all of these rights. And I also refer to the court in State versus Ballard, where even though strict compliance is necessary under when you're advising of constitutional rights, the court is allowed to look at a totality of the record. In State versus Ballard, the court even said that there was a colloquy back and forth between the trial judge and the defense attorney, where the defense attorney acknowledged that I had advised him of all his rights prior to this plea, and he acknowledged that he advised these rights. And while that can't be a substitute for the direct personal contact between the judge and the defendant, that could also be considered as a totality of the record. And in this case, that's exactly what happened. The defense attorney acknowledged prior to the hearing that he had the opportunity several times, my time is up, but I would ask the court to reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals in the second proposition of law, and also to adopt language that we set forth in the first proposition.
Thank you, Mr. Collada. Mr. Partlow.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, I'd like to clarify certain things that actually came up, I think, in oral argument today for the first time. I think the state has taken some liberties with the record in terms of the function of the interpreter, and I don't fault them for that because in this case the attorney representing the state was also representing the state at the trial level. I was not. Consequently, it's quite easy for me to just look at the record as the record. This court has recently, and I unfortunately didn't bring the disc with me last night to look at it, but recently there's been some changes, I think, in the rules of superintendence about how we do interpreters. Basically, this record just shows us the interpreter was there, as is the case with most records where there's an interpreter. You don't have the interplay between the interpreter and the defendant, even if it is there. Here, we simply don't know, and that's how the court should look at it. With regard to the language by the Court of Appeals referring to the written...
Actually, doesn't the record say that the trial judge asked him if he needed the interpreter for the plea, and he said he did not? I thought the record said that the trial judge asked him if he needed the interpreter for the plea, and he said he did not. So the interpreter was standing by, but not interpreting as the plea was made.
The record shows that the interpreter indicated and that the defendant has some understanding of the English language. Beyond that, we don't know. There is no affirmative statement, I'm not going to participate in this hearing or anything of that nature.
If you ever use an interpreter, you have to go through an oath with the interpreter, put it on the record. And I mean, those are requirements that, as a trial judge, you had to do.
Now you do.
I did it. I when I was a trial judge, I understood you had to do it then.
Well,
I always did it.
It was sometimes done then. I've seen many transcripts where it was not done.
The interpreter interprets without being sworn in as an interpreter with the oath of the interpreter that's required?
I had one transcript where the fact that the interpreter was even there was only indicated by the fact that there was an entry appointing one. So today, I think we're in a lot better shape on that, but I think it would be taking liberties here with the record as it exists to determine the precise role of the interpreter. Moreover, Your Honor, I'm not sure it's dispositive. I'm not sure my arguments today would be any different if we had somebody born and bred in Columbus, Ohio.
Actually, your argument would probably be weaker because the language that the court uses is simpler to understand than compelled.
Simplicity is not always what we're seeking here, Your Honor. And along with the question, in terms of the written guilty plea, the written guilty plea used the word compel, and that's what we want. The reason the Court of Appeals did not defer to that is because the rule requires that we, that the trial judge personally address him, and that these written pleas of guilty, frankly, Your Honor, sort of touched a nerve on that one, because I've had several cases where the written guilty plea was wrong in some respect. But if the personal colloquy between the trial judge and the defendant is correct, then it's affirmed. So I don't think we can have it both ways. There is a purpose for these written guilty pleas. I think they're very useful prior to the oral plea being taken, but they are not a substitute for being personally addressed by the trial judge. With regard to Justice Douglas' questions concerning what happens, I would have to disagree with the prosecutor on that account. This guilty plea has been vacated. We are back at a new trial at this point. With regard to Justice Pfeiffer's question, how was the defendant harmed? It has been the law in every court of appeals where I've dealt with guilty pleas, and that's quite a few, Your Honor, that if we're talking about the constitutional mandates contained in Criminal Rule 11, prejudice need not be shown. And when you think about it...
So if we are talking about a straight-up legal argument, there is no reliance to his detriment...
None of that, no.
The way the judge...
No, and the reason that that's not there, Your Honor, is because, frankly, if you made that requirement, you would totally eliminate the purpose of the rule. It's never going to be able to be shown in a direct appeal context, because all that kind of stuff's off the record, and we know that. Your Honors...
Are you taking up the cause of the Court of Appeals on its choice of words, you know, its failure to use the exact word compel, or, and maybe both? Are you taking up both causes, that the wording was not constitutionally sufficient?
Yes.
And I think that the Court of Appeals also secondarily said, and there's also a constitutional requirement that a court orally tell a defendant that his statements cannot be used against him.
Right. His silence cannot be used against him. Your Honor, I'm taking up both causes. I would have to disagree that the Court of Appeals follow that. That was my argument before the Court of Appeals. What I fail to understand about that, though, the state correctly pointed out that the focus of my argument to the Court of Appeals as appellant at that time was this failure to advise that your silence can't be used against you. I've always felt that's a very central part of the Fifth Amendment.
They did not
rule that way, though.
And nor have other courts. Have they?
No, nor have other courts in the state of Ohio.
Right.
And, Your Honor, but interestingly, read the cases very carefully cited by the states. It's often done. It's very often done that they're told their silence can't be used against them. Your Honor, with regard to the fact that the Court of Appeals, you know, did not, in essence, buy what I was selling with that proposition of law, but nevertheless reversed, I don't understand what the big deal is. That Court of Appeals, every Court of Appeals I've ever been to, if you raise a general issue, is very likely to come along and buy neither argument submitted by the appellant or appellee, but if it sees a problem, do its proper legal ruling. I don't see a problem with that. It certainly came up at oral argument. If anybody had wanted to brief it further, they could have asked and done so.
You would agree, would you not, that the exact language of Rule 11 does not require your extra phrase? You're reading that into it as a result of the Fifth Amendment.
As far as the statement concerning your silence not being used against you, the precise language of Rule 11 does not require that. Neither does the precise language of Rule 11 allow you to say you need not. It uses the word compel. Now, where are we at? I don't believe that the word compel has to be used. I have not argued that in the brief, and I don't think that that's the law in the state of Ohio. I think that unlike what the prosecutor said, you could say compulsory process, and that would be sufficient. I don't agree with that. I don't think saying compulsory process would be sufficient. Rule 11 tells us you have to tell them that you can't be compelled to testify. this court's prior rulings tell us that you need not use the word compel or any other word contained in Rule 11, but you need to express the intent of the rule in a language that is sufficient to meaningfully advise the defendant of the rule.
So specifically, what is it that you believe, what do you argue that was, what part of the rule itself was not met here with the language used by the trial court?
There's no concept of compulsion conveyed at all.
The half, were the words he used
half
too?
No, the words, let's, first, before we pursue this, let's read what he said. It's very short. He said, you could testify, but you need not testify if you desire not to. Walking over here this morning, I was trying to think of some sort of analogy to express what we're trying to say here. And I got to the corner, and I thought, well, I could cross, but I need not cross. But that doesn't mean some police officer can't come along and make me cross.
This court's role suggests that we would take this case because it had constitutional implications. But as you frame the issue, I wonder if this that this case is really whether or not this case is really asking this court to write any kind of law. You know, we're going to parse those particular syllables. But the law is plain. You know, it says words that either the words compel or something that means the same thing. Now, if we were right on this issue, we would say, in this case, the court, the words used by the court didn't mean the same thing or did mean the same thing. So where are we? I'm not sure that this case really warrants or could benefit the bench and the bar.
Your Honor, the most difficult part of this case for me personally, and I've been here several times, and I suspect I'll be coming back, was understanding initially why it was taken. Because there's nothing that this court can do, and I'm not trying to belittle the court. I'm talking about the real world here. If we're going to have a rule that lets judges deviate from the precise language of Rule 11, which we already have from Ballard, and which seems to be a good rule. If we're going to have a rule like that, though, we're going to have exactly what we have happening every day now. Judges all over the state are saying all sorts of things in plea colloquies. Is there a form? As far as I know, most counties have a form, and they're not all the same. As far as I know, every county, is it always used? No. Is it used more often than that? Probably not. I think the Supreme Court of Ohio cannot possibly review all these on a case-by-case basis and say, well, these words work and these words don't. It would be a never-ending task. We already have a rule. The Court of Appeals, pursuant to a direct appeal as of right, said, well, these words don't work, at least in the context of this plea. Going back to Ballard.
But more importantly, do you say the Court of Appeals did not add a caveat that the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, requires the judge to go beyond the, you know, you cannot be compelled, and further say, and your silence cannot be used?
No, they did not, Your Honor. And where that becomes very clear,
okay.
Where that becomes very clear, if you want to nail it right down, look at their ruling on the motion to certify the conflict. There was a motion made to certify the conflict, which basically said
that. You say that maybe clarifies the opinion, but we took the case on the judgment at the appeal judge, the appeals court judgment itself. Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to presume to talk about why the court, I don't know, but I do know that they make clear in that entry that no, we're not saying that. In fact, Your Honor, this wasn't the first time I'd made that argument to this Court of Appeals. I've made it probably half a dozen times, and it's always been rejected.
Isn't the problem with the words that the judge used is that it leaves the impression that the defendant, it's a totally discretionary act on the part of the defendant. Whether he needs to testify or not suggests that
that he decides, and he doesn't, he's not told that separately from that, no one can make you testify. This, you decide whether you, the word need is a little, it's not a very good word in this sense, certainly in this context, but it doesn't say to him at all anything about what someone else may force him to do if he decides, I don't need to testify.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that the problem with the wording?
Yes, Your Honor.
If the judge had used the term forced instead of compelled, because he thought perhaps somebody would understand the word forced better than compelled, there wouldn't be a problem, I would guess, with the use of that word.
No, Your Honor. If you read the cases cited by the states from other districts, frequently there is language like we have here, followed by a sentence that you can't be compelled, a sentence that you can't be forced, a sentence that no one can make you. I believe that's in there, Your Honors. And yes, that is the crux of the problem. Your Honors, with regard to the amicus filing, the only thing I'd like to mention is on several occasions in there, they seem to say that any mention of something contained in the rule should be sufficient. I don't think that's the law under the ballot. Under Ballard, I certainly don't think it should become the law now. Additionally, amicus warns of hours-long plea hearings by complying with the rule. You have the right to a jury trial where you may testify but cannot be compelled to do so, and your silence may not be used against you. Now, if you accept both our propositions, that's all the time you've taken. If you only accept the second one, you haven't even taken that much time. I don't think there's any danger of hours-long plea hearings, but let's say there was a danger of half-hour plea hearings. Say there was. I still don't think that's true, but we're talking about somebody who's going away for 15 years. Not only that, we're talking about the law of the state of Ohio, where in some cases people are going away for 20 years, 30 years, life sentences. I'm not sure that a few minutes extra by the trial judge, if that were the case, would be a deciding factor or should be a deciding factor in any event, Your Honors. We would ask that you affirm the Court of Appeals. There are no further questions.
Mr. Collada, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Well, very briefly then, addressing Justice Cook's concern about taking this case, the problem is that the court implicitly adopted the view that sounds can be inferred. There's no explanation in this judgment entry as to what the basis of their ruling is. But
say that again? You think that they didn't adopt the view
that the view that it's
silent.
Required to advise a defendant that you have to use their...
Guilt can be...
Right. Guilt can be inferred from their silence. And there's language in this opinion, which I want to address to the, point out to the court very quickly, which says, accordingly, Criminal Rule 11C must be read in a manner in which it complies with constitutional requirements expressed beyond the rule itself. So the Court of Appeals, there's language in this opinion saying, you need to go beyond Criminal Rule 11. Well, there's no other cases in this state which require that. And if I was a defense attorney and this was the language in this opinion right here, I would be citing this language in every case where my client was not advised that his rights, was not advised that his silence could be used against him. And that language needs to be corrected. And thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. I'll take a brief recess.
Oh.